Good morning. So last time we finished up talking about the calling convention. Giving some examples of how we write functions that can be called and emphasizing that the calling convention is about what you as someone calling a function or being called by a function, you know, can observe, not about specific rules you have to follow if no one knows. Like, you can save variable register, however you like, as long as whatever you're doing restores their values correctly and doesn't overwrite stuff that you don't have control of. Talked about a few nits about extra instructions, briefly about AND/OR and XOR not being the logical operations, being bitwise, and about flags being set by things other than comp. So you'd see reading compiler-generated code that arithmetic instructions that weren't, you know, comp, like subtract, would set the flags based on comparing to zero. And compilers would take advantage of this. And we also mentioned the test instruction, which is basically not quite the same as comp with zero. We looked at a bit of some assembly examples. Talked a bit about assembly or boilerplate. When you look at the output of Clang, you have all this sort of file type info, you have these directives, like often start with CFI, and it's like marking the type of labels. That's mostly to help the debugger and maybe implementing exceptions. And you have this code you didn't write that ends up in your .o file from the header files for things like setting up cout so it works. We talked about name mangling. So in C++, we can do things like have double colons in our function names. That's not a thing you can put in an assembly function name where it has to be a label that you put a colon after. We also can have different arguments to functions with the same name, and we need to represent that in assembly with different names. So there's this name mangling scheme that C++ uses in order to do that mapping. So any questions about any of the topics from last time? Okay. So one thing I showed you last time was looking at assembly code for generated functions. And I pointed out that optimized code is a lot cleaner and recommended using it. There's one thing I regret not going over, which is the issue that sometimes when you're just trying to find out how does something happen, the compiler is maybe a little too clever. So, for example, if you take this code and run it with optimizations, you might get this assembly for the example function. And that's a valid thing for the compiler to do because it knows, oh, foo always returns 42. I don't actually need to call it. I can just substitute 42, add 1 to it. Oh, that's 43. Just put that in the assembly. It's a valid thing to do, not very nice. And the workaround, which probably would have been more helpful to tell you on Wednesday before you started doing the post lab, is the easiest one is just don't have the function in the file. Like, then the compiler obviously can't do that trick. It has to actually call it because it doesn't have the code for it. Okay, so any questions on this? Okay. So there's one other topic related to things you might see in assembly that we kind of gloss over. And this is something called frame pointers. So our stack pointer points to the top of the stack. So the lowest end of the stack, where we're going to next allocate something on the stack. That's our traditional notion of how the stack works. And it's often been common to have an additional pointer to the stack called the frame pointer, which is a pointer to the allocation record or the stack frame, usually to the beginning of the storage for things put on the stack by the caller. So just after the return address. It's the usual place where this frame pointer would point. This isn't required by the calling convention, and it makes sense because you can just use RSP instead. You know how much stuff you push to the stack. You can obviously use that knowledge with a little bit of work to access anything on the stack using RSP. You don't need this other pointer that's always going to be a fixed distance away from it. Nevertheless, x86 has the RBP register, which stands for base pointer. That's another name for a frame pointer. So here, this is base pointer. And it's intended for this. And in fact, especially in 32-bit mode, there are instructions which are specifically meant to work with RSP and RBP, or ESP and EBP, in a way which makes them work like a frame and stack pointer. That we haven't seen, we won't talk about, because in modern systems you won't see them very often. But you might see this happen in code that's generated, because on some systems, especially without optimizations, using frame pointers is the default. So why would you want a frame pointer if I told you that like it's basically just RSP offset by a fixed value? What's the advantage of having this? Something that makes more convenient. So we have, so to be clear, what we're doing is we have our return address, and we have our saved regs, and we have our locals, and the base pointer, if we use it, you know, and would point to just after the return address. So why would that be more convenient? Any theories? Yeah.
At the end of the function, instead of remembering how many things you put on stack, you can just set stack to base pointer.
Yeah, so one answer is that this makes it easier to return. You don't need to remember how much stuff you need to pop off. You just, how many local variables you allocated, you just use this pointer. You have a different answer?
No, it's the same.
Okay. Yeah, so that's one good reason. And that's probably the most significant reason. So deallocating the stack space is move RSP RBP. RBP is a pointer to just before where the return address is. You're done. To the return address, I should say. This is to the return address, the traditional code. There's other things you can do. So sometimes we'll do dynamic stack allocations. This is a thing that is not a feature of C++, but has been offered as sort of a OS-specific extension, often called Alloca, which I don't know why it's called that, but that's the name, which allocates something on the stack instead of on the heap. So it goes away when the function returns, but it's faster to allocate. Also notably, it makes it easier to write debuggers. If you think about a debugger, one of the big things your debugger does is it figures out what function called this function, what function called that. And if we have a rule that we always have a frame pointer, makes it easier. And in fact, we have a better version of the rule, which is that we have our return address, and we have the old RBP here. And this is actually where traditionally our frame pointer would point. And then we have other saved stuff. So this means that as a debugger, what you do, if you learn, okay, the program segfaulted, here are the registers, and here's the contents of the stack, you have a stack pointer here, which some local variables, you look at RBP, you find the old RBP, and that takes you further up the stack to another old RBP and another return address. And you can keep going up, and you can figure out what called what, and you just list all the return addresses. You look up what the line of code they correspond to is, and then you print out a stack trace saying this was called here, this line was called by this line, all the way up to me. So this is something that's handy for debuggers, and we're just, if you want to make an error with a stack trace. And so that's another reason why it's often a default on systems, is that, you know, even though it's wasteful for the normal case, it makes debugging, making debuggers a lot easier. So our current debuggers are fancier than this and can make a stack trace without this information. But this, that means that they need to have some way of looking up, hey, I stopped in the middle of this code, RSP is here, how do I find the return address? They need to have some way of looking it up, even though that location varies. And that's something that modern compilers can do, but it obviously makes the debugger a lot more complicated. So our live machines don't default to using them, at least if you turn on optimizations. Sometimes I've seen Macs default to using them even with optimizations on. There are compiler flags to explicitly turn on and off frame pointers. And yeah, and if you have a debugger which isn't that smart, that would be a reason you would turn it off. That's probably the most common reason to explicitly, sorry, turn it on. That would be the most common reason to turn frame pointers on, is that you want, you know, no omit frame pointer, I want to use this stupid debugger to get stack traces and have it work every time. And the typical frame pointer code that you might see is you save the old frame pointer, you save the stack pointer into the frame pointer, and then at the end of the function, you just restore the old stack pointer from that frame pointer and return. And pop RBP and return. That's a very important omission. So any questions about frame pointers? Yeah.
Can you go back to the previous slide? Yeah. Right below the move RDP comma for SP, is it like subtract RDP comma 32?
So why, the question is, after we move RDP to RSP, why don't we subtract from RDP? So the stack, the top of the stack is still RSP. So when we want to allocate space on the stack, we still need to change RSP. So we don't ever change the frame pointer. The frame pointer always needs to point to the old RBP, which is next to the return address. That is all we are allowed to do. So we push the old RBP, we make the frame pointer point there, then we restore it at the end and pop the old RBP because it's a call or safe register.
To keep the original RSP value.
Yeah, so yeah, we keep the original RSP value because the RSP is pointing to, is where we actually do allocations. We aren't allowed to allocate by changing the RBP. The rule is that if you don't change the RSP and you're accessing memory that is too far below it, that's an error. And like if you try this on a real system, you'll find out that if you access memory too far below RSP, that you'll segfault. But so even if you're doing it through RBP. It is also common to use RBP to access local variables when you're using the frame pointer. So rather than keeping track of the offset from the top of the stack, you keep track of the offset from the frame pointer. And the advantage of that is that if you push something on the stack in the middle of the function, that this offset doesn't change. And if you're writing assembly by hand, that can be a lot very convenient. For compilers, it's not really a big deal to keep track of where the top of the stack is moving and always include the right number there. But it might be different if you're writing assembly by hand. Okay, so let's go through another assembly example just to make sure we're well, and have good practice with this. So here's a function which finds the max of two variables. Does the straightforward, comparison, chooses the value to assign to a local variable, and then returns. So we can look at our naive assembly. Notice that unlike many of the other examples I showed you here, we're using dword and EDI ESI. And why is that? Why aren't we using RSI, RDI? What happened in this C code back here? Int, yes, because I declared ints, ints are 4 bytes, so it turns into the 32-bit values. That. So another notable thing that, you know, I didn't do in my handwritten examples is that we're using space on the stack, and when I compiled this with Clang without optimizations, it decided, okay, we're just going to use space below the stack pointer directly. Which it turns out you're allowed to do as long as you don't do too much. So that's what it decided to do. So we have our return address, and we have space for x and y, which are copied from the two argument registers. And we also have a variable at minus 12, which must represent the variable the max, because that's what's returned at the end. And we know this is the unoptimized version, so the compiler decided to put all the variables in the stack, even though that's probably not the smart thing to do. And you know, it is doing all sorts of inefficient things that, you know, we could avoid by using registers better. But other than that, any questions on what's happening here? Yeah?
What is the purpose of moving ESI to the register, to the stack and then comparing it with EDI?
So what's the purpose of doing moving ESI to the stack and then comparing it? So there's some subtlety here. So this is the same as this. So we're kind of swapping the two, and then we're comparing it with the old ESI. So this is actually comparing the original ESI and EDI, but they're changing places. And probably what Clang did is Clang said, okay, I'm allocating X and Y on the stack. Okay, now I need some temporary registers. And I just have a list of registers that I use as temporaries. And the first ones on the list are probably RSI and RDI, because they're caller saved, and they're first argument registers, so like they're the most unlikely to be used by the caller anyways. And, you know, it doesn't not, there's no optimization, so it's not trying to do anything clever with how it uses registers. Okay, so obviously, as I mentioned before, this is not the smart code. So this is the advanced version that Clang generates if you add optimizations. Way more straightforward. It uses one weird instruction, which is cmove ge, which is move if greater than or equal. This is based on the last comparison. In this case, we have an explicit comp instruction. Okay, so let's look at a more complicated function. So here we have compare string. So this is basically string comp, but it only handles the equal case. I guess you don't know string comp. It's, yeah, comparing two strings, are they equal? So it returns whether they're equal or not. And it uses, these are C-style strings, so we expect the string to be an array, where if the string is, say, foo, the array contains foo and ends with a backslash zero, which is ASCII the ASCII character with the integer value 0. So we're going to look at the optimized version of this code, because given how long this function is, it would not be very fun to look at the unoptimized version, where we have lots of stuff. And things get a little strange because we're dealing with, well, the probably worst name registers in x86, because we're dealing with bytes. So we load a byte from the location of our first argument, and then test if it's 0. So this is a test if it's 0. Because remember, test is basically the same as comp with 0, and then we're checking, was that equal? And if it's 0, what does that mean? That means that our first argument was an empty string. And we're going to skip ahead to just checking whether the other string was also empty, which we're going to actually do by doing this comparison down here of saying we're at a null character in the first string. Is that the same thing in the second string? Okay. So then we have these funny instructions here. So move ZX. What is move ZX? So if you look that up in a manual, this is move 0 extend. So this is an instruction which is taking a byte and moving it into a 32-bit register. And so it's called move 0 extend because it adds zeros to the end of it. That is apparently what Clane decided to do to implement this. So it does this to get two values to compare. If they're not equal, it jumps ahead. This is, again, to the return statement. Then it loads the next character, increments the pointers. So these are both, ink the pointer, and ink the pointer. And also checks whether we're at the end again. And note that this, and then this is a loop. So, questions about this? So, this is the main loop where we load two characters, compare them, increment the pointer, see if we're at the end. If not, keep going. And that's what Clane decided to generate for this, which is basically a straightforward translation of that code. The only weird thing is it moved this comparison to the bottom of the loop and put an extra copy at the top. Okay. So then we have the final code at the end where we figure out the return value. And there's one weird thing which happens here, which is that we use this set E instruction. So set E is set if equal. So this makes AL be 1 if it was equal and 0 otherwise. And that's how we set the return value, because remember that EAX and RAX and AX and AL are all the same register. So AL is actually the return value register. Okay. So any questions about this? So you've seen that, so when compilers generate assembly, they do some things which aren't entirely intuitive, but usually you get code that, makes a lot of sense. So let's look at another example of a recursive function. And here, Clang does things which are very non-intuitive. So here, this is just a standard fib function. We check if n is 0 or 1. If so, we return 1. Otherwise, we do the recursive call. So the first thing that if you look at the optimized code Clang generates for this is that it does the check for is it equal to 0 or 1, which is what's implemented at the beginning in a really strange way. So first we have normal boilerplate, where we save two callee save registers. Then we saved RAX. And you might say, wait, RAX is not a callee save to caller save registers. Callee save registers, yes. REX is not a callee save register. We don't have to save it, right? It's the return value. We're going to change it anyways. So why do you see Clang with optimizations, where it's pretty good at not generating code which does nothing, doing this? And the answer is that if you read the official specification for the 64-bit x86 Linux calling convention, there's this guarantee that RSP must be a multiple of 16 when you call a function. And they need to make that happen, and they do that by incrementing the stack pointer with a push instruction that doesn't push anything useful. And if you write code which calls functions, you'll commonly see this sort of, why is this value being pushed that doesn't make any sense? That's why. Yeah?
So is Rex being populated?
Sorry?
Is Rex at the end, is it going to be
popped? Yeah, so something has to be popped to adjust the stack pointer back, yes. But it's not being done into REX because we're just using it to move the stack pointer. So then we have this bizarre implementation of if n is 0 or 1. Where our n is in EAX. And well, the parts which matter are here, and here, and here. So these are the lines which matter. So if EAX, so remember OR is bitwise OR. So if EAX is say 2, which is in binary 0, 0, and we OR with 1, we get 0 ordered with 1 is 1, 1 ordered with 0 is 0, we got 3. But if we OR EX equals 1, OR 1 is 1, and 0 OR 1 is 1. So that's what they're doing here, is that they're ORing with 1, then comparing to actually to do it with 1 compare, which is a trick that Clang is pretty good at figuring out because someone wrote a lot of code to like have some formulas to figure out all the things we could OR to make this comparison faster and do that. And so that's why you see that sort of code. So there's another big trick that's done here. And that's going to be up here. So EBX is previously n, so we subtract 2 from n, and then we do our recursive call of fib of n minus 1. So there's a recursive call. Good. You might say, wait a moment, I don't see any other call instructions, and there's the return. That's a good question. Like, weren't there two recursive calls? What happened to the other one? But what we have instead is we have a loop here. This is a conditional jump backwards, so that's a loop. And what Clang has cleverly done is it has replaced the call to fib of n minus 2 with a loop where it checks whether we're at the base case yet. And if not, we jump backwards after doing undo the additions. So this is the, plus. This is where we're accumulating the value here. So this is the add to produce the return value. So this R14 here ends up going into RAX, into our return value. But we've replaced the actual second recursive call with just a loop, which Clang has the logic to do that itself, bizarrely. Even though that seems like a pretty difficult thing to write general code to like transform our standard fib function into a loop like this. So any questions about what's going on here? So that's a brief look at crazy things our compilers do. And so one last remark on a topic we probably should mention about security. So here's a function. We just read in to a buffer, which is, if we do that with cin, it's just going to read in a null terminated string. And the way this is going to be implemented is we allocate some space in our stack for the buffer. We pass the address of the buffer to the implementation of the insertion operator, or extraction operator, the operator greater than, and then we call it. And then we deallocate the space and return. So that makes sense. So what happens if I input a string which is longer than the buffer?
Start trying to overwrite memory on the heap or the stack.
So it starts trying to overwrite memory on the heap or the stack, and you correct it to the stack. The stack is right because that's where its argument is. So presumably it's going to start an RSP and keep going. And so what it's going to look like is we call the operator greater than, and it has its return address on the stack, and just above it, because of what our assembly code did, is that buffer. And we actually, for some reason, our compiler, and this is a common thing which will happen, allocated a bit of extra space. The reason is because of that alignment requirement, that multiple of 16 requirement. So we have our buffer, we have 20 bytes of unused space, and then we have some sort of return address, which points, say, this might be, pointer to, let's say, main, points somewhere in main, for example. That would be an example of where that return address would point. And if we input a small string, it's going to take up the first part of the buffer. If we input a longer one, take up more. And if we input a very large string, well, it's going to overwrite additional memory on the stack. And the first thing that's important it's going to overwrite is that return address. And if we're really clever, we can make that return address now point to something that we chose, which is actual machine code. And this is sort of the classic example of a security vulnerability that results from not checking your bounds. And the easiest to exploit. So there's lots of problems like this because we mix in our control information and our actual data, where we can have someone who we don't trust who controls data, and if we mess up where we put that data, they can end up changing what code we run in ways which just the inputs, by reading the C++ code shouldn't be able to do, right? If you read our original C++ code here, there's no way that inputting anything into the buffer is supposed to cause anything in particular to run. So, any questions about this? Yeah.
Could you put malicious code in the buffer and then make the return address point to
it? So the question is, could you put malicious code in the buffer and make the return address point there? Yes. With the exception that on modern systems, that's harder than it used to be. So it used to be the case that that would always work. Because this is such a problem, systems have taken countermeasures, which you can learn if you, say, take Defense Against the Dark Arts. And one of the simplest countermeasures is to make it so trying to execute code that's on the stack causes a sec fault. So you have to do something else. Which it turns out, doing something else that lets you execute the code you want is actually not hard. So the easiest way is that you probably should not have an interface to CN like this, right? Like CN should just say, this is not a function I provide. Like that's the easiest and simplest protection. There are some sort of more band-aid-y solutions. So like one example is you can like put some value before the return addresses and check it before you return. But then there's an issue of what if I put that value in my input, how do you keep me from doing that? Yeah, something like that. Usually you choose a random value, so you hope it's not in the input. You hope that someone can't put it in the input, but that's not perfect. The principled solution is you just do not provide interfaces that write outside the bounds of arrays. And this CN into a buffer like that is an example of something which, if we were designing C++ today, probably would not exist. Like, that would probably be an error. Just because like it's technically possible to use this safely because you can set limits on, because like if you have a string stream, for example, which is, you can like guarantee it fits in the buffer, but it's not worth it, is probably. And so if you are designing APIs, please always provide lengths with arrays. Don't just assume they're big enough. So, let's move on to our next topic. So, the so-called advanced C++. So, for the lab after the exam, which by the way is next Tuesday, we're going to have you look at some things that involve some features of C++ we haven't looked at yet. First, I'm going to briefly remind you about things you should know. I assume everyone's comfortable with pointers. So star declares a pointer and dereferences pointers. Ampersand declares a reference and makes pointers. Yes, inconsistency. That's how it works, so hopefully you remember that. So ampersand declares a reference, but when used elsewhere, it doesn't dereference a reference because you don't need to. If you use a reference, it automatically refers to the thing that it's bound to. So if you use an ampersand elsewhere, outside of a declaration, it creates the address of that value, which is a pointer. And we've seen the assembly implementation of both of these, and references and pointers are things which look very different in sort of natural C++ code, but in assembly, they're the same thing. They're pretty much exactly the same. And we also, if you remember, we have pointers have types. So if you have a pointer, a double, you try to make that into a pointer to an int, you get an error. Can't do that. So C++ cares about the types of pointers. But we know from assembly that that's not a real thing in the machine. That in assembly, this is just, you know, like RAX, which contains an address. Like, there's no actual difference. This is something our compiler is enforcing to help us out, hopefully. But there's no real difference between how these pointers are represented, just like there's no difference between how a pointer and a reference is represented in assembly. This is just convenience for us as a programmer. And just to briefly review, so you remember if we have pointer, we use it directly, we get the address. If we dereference it, we get the value that points to. We can use it to change the value. Remember that if you compare pointers, that compares the addresses. If you compare the things pointed to in C++, that uses the appropriate comparison operator. So for this example, if you wrote a list node operator equals equals that does something reasonable, you presumably will get true. And references, if we remember, are sort of like automatically dereference pointers, and that means if you have two references to the same thing, they have the same address. So this is, should all be all review, just while I'm kind of rushing through it. Anyone want me to spend more time on this? Everyone comfortable? Yes, good. Just move on. I don't care about pointers. I know all of that. Okay, and most people have no opinion. Interesting. Okay. And I guess the other thing that people struggled with when we had the ST assignment is that you can have pointers to pointers, which, you know, just reminding you that that's a thing that exists. You can have nest the pointer types. The representation, again, is all the same. These are just addresses. So in assembly, if we're putting these on the stack, it's going to be something like this. Like, we have some value of gao, and the pointers are just the address of the other pointers. And just as a reminder, we also saw references to pointers versus pointers to pointers, mentioning this because I know people got confused by this on a certain lab. So here, you know, these are the same, because remember, a reference is an automatically dereference pointer. So if we're thinking about our tree node stuff, if you're using a reference to a pointer, that's the same as having a pointer to a pointer and then dereferencing it. You're changing the thing pointed to. And passing something which takes it by reference is the same, you know, as making a pointer and then needing to explicitly dereference it later. So this code that we supplied you, it took a reference to and left. That meant that you were passing into this insert function not just the node to where you wanted to insert, but the pointer you wanted to be changed by the insert, whether that was a root pointer or a left pointer or a right pointer. And that's, yes?
Was the end left and right also like the pointer, right?
So question is end left and right? Yeah, so this is if we have our tree node, we have left, right. This get means that n is a pointer to this, which points to some other tree node or to null. And that's true in either, the n in the call. And that's true in either case. It's just that in one case it's a pointer to it, in one case it's a reference to it. So the syntax is different, but the you know, the argument passed in assembly is going to be the address of left, not the value it contains, which is the other tree node, or null. And so another way of looking at this was that we could have returned the value instead of modifying it through the reference or a pointer to a pointer. So instead of setting n through the reference or setting star n to modify the thing pointed to, we could have returned the new value. And instead of setting n, we could have used the return value to set n left and set n right. So any questions on any of these? Okay, so Bloomfield slides have sort of several examples of sort of memory allocation issues. So like here, for example, we're getting a pointer to the allocated memory. I assume this is mostly review for everyone. So yes, maybe, please, or absolutely not, please go over it. Can I have show? Yes. Okay, so I'll go through this just very quickly. So one common mistake that people made is here we have a pointer. This is pointer to the stack, which after we call this, well, this also uses the stack. So that's a bad thing. There's another problem, which is that this is passed by value, not by reference. So this still has, you know, uninitialized, and this is still uninitialized. And so the sort of fix for that would be something like this. Questions? And okay. And we had our other, so the other classic issue that's more subtle is we talked about memory leaks. So if you do something like this, that new double is gone. Like it's never freed, it's still allocated. This is on the heap, remember, which is that other region of memory that the stack grows towards. Subtle thing here. This is a syntax error. So you can have these blocks in C++. Variables are local to them. And the way that works with the stack is you can think of this as sub RSP here and add to RSP at the end of the block.
So it doesn't exist when you try to get it again?
Yeah. And this is doesn't exist in a stronger sense and that this is a compile error. Because it only exists within those braces. And sort of the justification for that is the natural code allocates space for it, then deallocates it.
When would you ever see code like that in the brackets?
So usually you don't just see bare brackets, though it occasionally comes up. The most common case where this sort of thing comes up is like the brackets are because of a loop or an if statement or something like that. Yeah, but bare brackets are valid syntax, and I've done it occasionally. Or like a try, catch. Okay. And yeah, and similarly, because of that, even if you take a pointer to it, yes, that pointer may survive, but you shouldn't do that. Okay, so that's, I'll skip over the remaining examples since you're comfortable enough. So we'll talk about next time about inheritance in C++. To give you the brief preview, here we had this class name. I'm going to inherit from it with this contact class. And there's two things I do. So I have this colon public name, and that's basically the same as extends name in Java. And I'm have this method I'm overriding where I'm calling the superclasses method. I use name colon colon print. That's basically the same as super.print would be in Java. So fairly straightforward so far. We're going to talk about how this might look in assembly a little bit on Monday, along with some types of inheritance that C++ supports that don't exist in Java.